My cell phone believes it is now recording the class, so hopefully that means I'll have it, even though I carelessly left my little pocket digital recorder at home. All right, so as usual, the first thing is, do people have questions from Monday's class that they'd like to discuss? Anything from what we did then that has occurred to you since? No. All right. Do people have any questions from the readings for this class that they would like to discuss? My usual line when I'm giving a talk and get to the question session is that the nice thing about answering a question when you've given a public lecture is you know there's at least one person in the room who's interested in what you're talking about. And I sort of have a similar feeling with regard to trying to get you to tell me what you found puzzling or interesting about the chapter, that we're more likely to focus on useful things if we do that than if I just sort of go through my summary of the chapters. Stop for a few seconds and see if you can think of any particular points you wanted to ask about. All right, yes?
I was going to ask, they went into a lot of talks about the theme.
About?
Never mind, actually.
What?
No.
All right.
Okay. I think I
just figured out. All right, good. All right, so let's talk about the one that was on the syllabus for discussing this time, which is actually getting closer to your business, and that's the State Attorney General litigation contract, where you're a lawyer and your state has thought, well, some other states got huge amounts of money from tobacco companies. Maybe we've got what looks like it might be a scandal about health care overbilling, I think it was. Maybe we can get a lot of money by suing them. But we've got four attorneys. They're all pretty busy, and a major case trying to get $1 billion out of somebody is not something within their abilities. So we're going to hire a law firm, possibly one that specializes in such cases, and going to have them do it for us. And then the question is, what sort of contract should we draw up? And in addition to all of the other issues that we've been discussing, since we're a government agency, we may even be run by an elected official, we're also worried not only about how well it turns out, but how well it's going to look about the sort of PR aspect. And so one might set it up as a sort of a grid where you could think of issues, compensation scheme, flat fee. All right, we will pay them $1 million and they will agree to try to get $1 billion out of these people. Hourly rate, that's an input charge, or contingent fee, that's an output measure. All right, those are the three alternatives we're considering. And for each of them, we could ask about what are the incentives we can ask about what is the risk allocation. And we can ask about the PR, the sort of political implications of what are the risks we've got that we're going to end up getting voted out of office as Attorney General because what we've done, even though we did a fine job in the interest of the state, it looks bad and therefore we might be in trouble. So let's start out with what we've been mostly talking about, which is incentives. Under the flat fee, what incentives do our lawyers have to do a good job of prosecuting the case, well, let's divide that in half. What incentive do they have to do a good job of spending resources winning the case and getting as large damages as they can is the first question. The second is, what incentive do they have to hold down the cost while they're doing it? How about with a flat fee, what are their incentives? Anybody? Yeah.
They certainly have an incentive to go all the way up to the amount of hours required, but they don't have an incentive to go beyond those dollars.
Or to use their best litigators, or to hire private detectives to investigate things that might show it. There are lots of ways they could spend money, but they're not being rewarded by whether they win. Now, they get some reward, of course, they got a reputation. They're going to want other contracts. But in terms of the direct fee structure, there is, let me exaggerate a little, no incentive to win.
All right?
And that's, it's not really true because they've got a reputation, but it is true in terms of the actual fee structure. On the other hand, what about holding down costs? They're paying all the costs, so incentive to hold down costs. What does this way of putting the question miss? What question should I have asked about incentive? I'm just getting another color of ink. What question about incentive should I have asked that I haven't asked yet? Going back to some of our other cases. What's wrong with my discussion of incentive so far? Ready? Let's keep going down this, and then we'll come back to that question. So suppose it's an hourly rate. They get paid so much per hour. Do they have an incentive to win from that? No. It's through a reputation, but they're paid on the unleash. So maybe I should have divided this up as to win and no incentive to win. How about holding down costs? There may be some costs that they're going to hold down, but on roughly speaking, they're being reimbursed by their costs. So little incentive to hold down costs, and if they're being paid too much, if, for example, at the time when you signed the contract, there was lots of litigation going on, and firms like this were fully employed, and then for some reason there was a tort reform law or some other external event, and now a quarter of their attorneys are twiddling their thumbs because there isn't enough business, they're going to have an incentive then to do too much work in charging.
What does the black line represent?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was my mistake. The black line represents something we haven't covered yet, and it should have gone down here. None to win, little on costs. And I'm going to draw this black line here to again signal that there's something we're leaving out and we should get to. And I'll leave it for a moment as a puzzle until we finish this step as to what we're leaving out. How about the contingency? Suppose we said you get 25% of whatever we win. They have an incentive to win. They have enough incentive to win. Suppose I'm taking a straight contingent fee, so they're paying all of the costs and getting rewarded with contingency. And suppose spending an extra $100,000 would increase on average the amount they win by $150,000. That's the amount we win. Will they do it? They're getting 25% of the return. If it costs $100,000 to increase the total return by $150,000, whether they're interested to do it or not.
Yeah. Well, I think generally we can say that they might not have the right incentive to win.
Right.
They may be incentivized to take too much risk in the litigation strategy because if they lose, they don't have any liability for a countersuit, whereas the city does. So they might take too much.
I wasn't considering the countersuit, but that's certainly a legitimate point that they're.
Or they might be too conservative in their litigation strategy because all they want to do is just make sure to earn some pay.
But I don't think that's the right way of putting it. The right way of putting it is that they spend $150,000, $100,000 to get $150,000. They only get a quarter of that $150,000. So they're losing money because they're paying the costs. They're getting a fraction of the benefit. Doesn't make sense. Exactly the same issue with moral hazard and insurance. All right, if my factory is 50% insured, and I can put in a $100,000 sprinkler system that will reduce the expected loss from fires by $150,000, I'm only getting $75,000 of that $150,000. The rest is gained to the insurance company, which will have to pay if the building burns down. so therefore it's not going to pay me. Maybe if I'm risk averse, I would. Ignoring that for a moment, it's not going to pay me to pay $100,000 to get 75. Well, similarly here, they're getting only a quarter of the return on a 25% contingency fee. They're paying all of the costs. So it makes sense for them to bear costs that produce at least four times the cost worth of benefit. It costs less than that, again, except for reputational and other incentives. No.
Am I right? Right, but at some point, like, if they do twice the amount of work, it won't turn into twice the amount of payout in...
Yeah, but that's not the relevant question. The relevant question is not twice the amount of work. It is X dollars more work. Right? If you suppose they could have a 50% chance of winning doing almost no work at all, it's really a good case. Double the amount of work, you're the 51%. That might be worth doing, because after all, doubling almost no work at all doesn't cost you very much. Right? So it's not the relevant proportions. Right? It's not division, it's addition. We're thinking about. We're thinking when you pay an extra so many dollars, what return do you get? Doesn't that make sense? No.
Yeah, but it would be best for the city if they did put in that extra amount of money.
That's right. That's right, and that's the problem. You're designing the contract. You have the interest of the city in mind. In fact, it's best for both of them, and the city, once you allow for the fact that the city will pay more for a contract that gives a better chance of winning. And then the question is how to design the contract. Think about it for a moment. Suppose, in order to give them exactly the right incentive to win, and again, I'm ignoring reputation, which can confuse things a little, what percentage of the take should they get? 100%, that's right, exactly. If they're getting 100% of the return, then any investment on winning that pays more than a dollar per dollar will do less than that they want. Putting aside what the restrictions may be under current law on contracts, how, if you wanted to give them that incentive, how would you structure your contract? How would you structure it in the interest of both sides, giving them 100% incentive? Nobody speaks. Straightforward. That's not quite right, yeah.
You pay.
We're imagining a moment of contingency, not a mixed one. Let's take a much simpler case. I've got a business. You're my manager. You're a really good manager. You're really competent at running your business, and I'm getting old and tired, and I don't like running the business anymore. Well, I could hire you to run the business, go off to Florida, you get 50%, we're going to have exactly the problem I described. What's the other obvious solution in that case? I sell it to you, you get 100% of the return, and you give me a fixed pay. Well, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about current legal restrictions on lawyers. But from an economist standpoint, if this was the only issue you were worried about, you would sell the case to the law firm. You would say to the law firm, all right, you collect whatever is collected, pay us the $500 million that's your and our estimate of the net profit from this thing, and we're all free. Yep.
Sorry, that's this is my last one, but
all right.
My point, I suppose...
I like conversation better than that, sure.
...was that the company might be more risk... or might be risk-averse, much more so than the city.
We haven't gotten...
The city would prefer a totally risk-neutral strategy. The company may be risk-averse because they want to guarantee some money from the...
They might be. That's the next problem. I was trying to separate it first incentive, then risk, then PR.
Sure, but I think it's the same thing as their incentive to win.
Yeah, that is true that their incentive to win, just as if I go back to my fire insurance case, you could have legitimately said, well, even though I'm spending $100,000 to only save $75,000, what I'm spending is really $100,000 to avoid a highly risky gamble with an expected cost of $75,000. I'm really spending $100,000 to avoid a risk of a $500,000 loss when my factory runs out. If I'm risk averse, I might do it anyway. So it's true that that's a further complication in how you do it. On the other hand, strictly speaking, right, it's getting complicated. strictly speaking, you ought to also include my risk aversion in the value of it. If I'm really risk averse, then we not only want me to spend $100,000 for $150,000 in gains, we even want me to spend $100,000 for $90,000 in gains, because the $90,000 is eliminating a highly risky outcome. That's the expected value. So if you went back and put everything in terms not of dollars, but sort of futiles of dollars adjusted for risk, then we're back with the same problem. If I'm not bearing all the costs, I don't take all of the decisions. Make sense? Anyway, you're right about this, the basic point. So contingency, they have a pretty good incentive to win, although not all the incentive you might like to have. And as I said, one possibility would be to sell the aces. And I've in fact argued for quite a long time that one of the respects in which the American legal system is a mere 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology is that tort claims aren't marketable. And I say 1,000 years behind because in Iceland, 1,100 years ago, tort claims were marketable, transferable. And that goes to a different course. Iceland was this fascinating, I don't know if you know about it, but our word saga comes from a body of literature produced in Iceland in about the 13th century. This is a population of about 70,000 people 1,000 years ago, and there are probably a dozen books they wrote currently in print in this. That's pretty interesting. But it was just a fascinating society, and among other things, it had a pure tort legal system, which you killed somebody, his relatives sued you. It also had a purely privately enforced legal system, in which after you got the court, there was a government court and a government set of laws, but no government, no executive arm of government. So after you get the judgment saying that he owes you 200 ounces of silver for having killed your brother or damaged your property or something, he then either pays or doesn't pay. If he doesn't pay, you go back to the court and the court declares an outlaw. It is legal to kill an outlaw. It is tortious to defend an outlaw. So it's really quite an interesting system going very, very far toward the privatization end, as it were, if possible. But part of the problem with such a system is what if I'm the victim of a tort and I don't have the resources to prosecute the claim? And the answer is, in that system, I transfer the claim to a neighbor who does have those resources. And if it's a really hard claim, I also do him some favors. If it's an easy claim, he splits the tape with me. But it was a system with transferable tort claims. And then you can argue that would make a lot of sense in our society, too. But that's a big question. Hopefully interesting. Anyway, so he has a good deal of the right incentive to win. And on the contingency fee, since he's paying the cost, he also has incentive to hold out costs. Right? To win and to hold out costs. So looking only at this end of it, it looks as though the contingency fee is the best system, and indeed the 100% contingency fee with a fixed payment the other way looks like the best system, but we're going to have to get to the other two columns before we say that. All right, so now what is my black line? What have we been neglecting in all of our talk about incentives? There are two parties to this contract. How about the incentives of our side, of the people who are hiring them? All right. Can you imagine, for example, cases where under the contingency or the flat fee for that matter, we might have the wrong, what's the decision that we're going to get to make when it's all over as the clients? But at least one critical decision that is going to be in the hands of the client, not the lawyer. We've already made that one. That's what we're doing here. How do most tort cases... That's right. How do most court cases end? Most tort cases don't end with a damage claim. They end up with a settlement. All right. Well, let us suppose... Let's take this one, which is the... Well, yeah, this one doesn't quite work. Let me take the worst of all words. Suppose I combine these two. 100% contingency fee, and we are paying your costs. But you're paying us a large lump sum in exchange. On those terms, when do we settle? Suppose that foolishly we construct the contract that any return, any damages or settlement goes to the lawyers. the Attorney General's office will pay the lawyers for its hourly costs, but the lawyers will pay us $500 million in advance for being able to take over the case and make the money. When are we going to settle?
No, I was going to say it would cost people what they have to pay, but it's a lot of money.
Yeah, we are much too nice people.
Mm-hmm.
On the contrary, we settled the first minute.
Uh-oh.
Right? They filed the case. They handed us $500 million. Why should we pay them any hourly money now that we've gotten our cash?
I was thinking
the other. Yeah, that's why it allows you to form a contract. But it emphasizes the fact that you have to think about the incentives of both parties. And that under a flat fee
system,
we're paying them a flat fee. Now what are our incentives with regard to settlement? The longer the case goes on, the higher the costs are going to be. Who's paying those costs under flat fee? The employee, the law firm, is paying the cost. So suppose that we're offered a $500 million settlement, and we say, you know, we've decided that if we go to trial, we're going to get $600 million. And the law firm says, well, that's all very well, but it's going to cost us $150 million of more of our time and effort to go to trial. So why don't you settle it? Well, you know, that's your problem, not our problem. Right? So therefore, the flat fee gives you too little incentive to settle, precisely because you're not addressing the costs. You're getting the benefit of the costs. Now, there may be other factors as well, and I haven't really thought out all of the incentives of the Attorney General's office. You could imagine. Well, let me take a very simple one. Let us suppose that a settlement offer is made, and it really doesn't seem like a very good settlement offer in this case, and the law firm advises against us, and we take it. Well, why do we take it? Well, it just so happens that the governor's reelection campaign got a very generous donation from some people having connections to the defendants in this case. So you have to worry a little bit about the possibility that we, the customers, once we transfer it, it just be some of the return from winning the case from the customers to the lawyers. You don't have to worry about the customers selling out the lawyers. That makes sense. So that would be a legitimate issue. So on the hourly fee, we collect all of the money, but we pay all of the costs. So what's our incentive to settle? Too much, too little, about right?
We're going to win more than it costs us.
And then that's the right rule in terms of maximizing the combined gain thus, right? So that we've got about the right incentive to settle because we're both getting the benefit and paying the costs.
Right incentive to settle.
Under the contingent fee, we now, the attorneys are paying all of the costs. We are getting 3/4 of the benefit. So if paying another $100,000 in costs will get $90,000 in additional benefit, it's worth it for us to do so because we're getting most of that benefit, but not all of it. So therefore, too little again. So that's just the incentive. Now how about risk? Flat fee, who bears the risk? Which risk? Who bears which risk? First, what are the two obvious risks in this case? What are the two uncertainties? The cost of doing it and the return, whether you win, how much you win. All right. So in a flat fee system, who bears the risk of winning? AG bears the risk of winning. And who bears the risk of the cost? Firm of cost. So one of them is bearing one of those risks, one of the other, and according to the circumstances, one of them might or might not be much larger than the other. how about under the hourly system? Who bears the risk of winning? Bill? And who bears the risk of cost?
I was more organized than would have been one column here for winning and length of cost. This will do.
And under the contingency, who bears the risk of winning?
Well, if you get 100%,
it's unlikely to be, that would be 100% contingency because the realistic one is shared, right?
Shared.
And who bears the risk of too much cost? So we were thinking about that. We can now see that this deal, this is the best one if you're only worried about the firm's incentives and not about the attorney general. And you can imagine doing this with a deal which says the firm decides whether to sell or not. It's really sold the case to them. It's their case now, all right? One of the couple of contexts in which you, to some extent, sell a case to someone else, I forget the technical term, but if you're insured and the insurance company, in effect, takes over your claim for damages, what's the name for that? Subrogation, I think, is the technical term. And I'm pretty sure that it's the insurance company then that can decide whether they're selling or not. So this problem could be eliminated if you sold it all the way. But other than that, on the other hand, this is one, in fact, both of these are ones where the firm bears the cost of the risk of cost, and if the firm is very risk averse and the attorney general isn't, then you might say that the costs are a real big risk. That's not going to be against those. And similarly, if the attorney general is very risk averse, then this looks like a better deal in terms of the risk of winning. If they get rid of all the risk of the cost and part of the risk of winning. Right, so for a very risk-averse attorney general, this looks like a pretty good deal. For a very risk-averse firm, it looks like a pretty bad deal. How about the PR? That's sort of, I haven't thought about that as much, so it's a somewhat, maybe somewhat more complicated issue, but how would you figure out what are the risks on the flat fee system? What are the PR risks? What's the situation in which the attorney general is going to look bad and they're going to lose the next election?
Do you think they're not giving the,
the voters aren't going to know all about this set of stuff, right? The voters are going to know what happened. And what's the situation in which the opposing candidate can say, look at how this guy throws away our money?
The firm doesn't have to win.
The firm doesn't win. That's what you're going to know. In the case where you have a sizable fee and the firm doesn't win, now it's going to look, after all, you know, it's a gamble, but you can't see the probabilities. So you see the outcome, so now you're going to have to worry in this case that they're going to lose the case, flat fee arrangement, and the other side is going to start muttering about the fact that you were probably being paid off by those high-priced lawyers to give them a bunch of our taxpayers' money. Right? That's what you're going to worry about. How about the hourly case? Now what are you afraid of? Same problem, right? You lose the case after spending a lot of hours. And again, they can say, look at how profitable these people are with the taxpayers' money. They threw away $100 million. Just think what kind of irresponsible behavior is that. How about the third case? Now what are you afraid of?
Selling it off, you're going to have the whole profit if they did it.
Well, we don't have to sit on my 100% case. You can hit the in general. This time you're scared about winning, not losing, politically speaking. Because if you lose, well, it didn't cost the taxpayers anything. You know, we made a gamble. Pity that that law firm spent a lot of trouble, time and trouble, but it didn't cost us anything. You might have done very well, yeah.
It's also like the sky really seems to be the limit on contingency. to you, like,
that's right. So we
almost scared of winning too big.
That's right. So that's what that was what it's like. Exactly. You're afraid that you're going to get a $1 billion judgment, and the other guy is going to say, "Do you realize that this candidate spent $200 million of your money hiring some lawyers? I know lawyers who work cheaper than that." Right. So you'd at least be a little bit worried about the PR consequences of a big win. Small win is great. Small win, you spent nothing. You got some money from the taxpayers. Loss isn't so bad. You spent nothing. You got nothing from the taxpayers. And you can say, yeah, but look, now people will be more careful about cheating us because they see that we're willing to sue. Might be a good argument, but you'd be a little worried about what you do. All right, so it's not a bad case. Even if I didn't admit it. All right. Actually, I don't have my camera with me either. And the question is, will this keep recording while I use it as a camera so that I will have a photograph of my board? Because I have generally put up again. All right, so I think I'm going to have two files. I'm going to have to figure out how to join for the recording. But it should have worked. We'll see. All right, so I can now erase that if I like. So the let's think about another question, which we haven't discussed and which they haven't discussed. You're the guy negotiating the contract in the Attorney General's office. What's your maxim? What is it that you're trying to maximize for your side, putting aside the political risks? What do you want out of this case? Is the only thing you care about money? How about if you conclude that, in fact, the people you're suing are innocent? Do you still want to win? Maybe you do. I'm not saying you don't. I'm only saying that it's not immediately transparent that, after all, when we looked at the total size of the pie, we're leaving out the defendant. And the defendant is paying all this money. And you could certainly imagine cases in which you would be concerned about that. For example, let's take the following case. Suppose you conclude, maybe before the case starts, that you say, well, look, actually, I didn't do anything wrong. But given the nature of the legal system, we can make a plausible enough case that they did do something wrong to extort money from them. So they'll say to themselves, look, there's a 20% chance that these demagogues will talk the jury into giving a $1 billion judgment, so we'll pay off $200 million for a settlement. What might you consider if you're the representative of the state drawing up the contract and you think that might be the situation? Is that an unambiguously good thing if you can get that $200 million? $200 million is nice, but are there any downsides? What's the long-run consequence of your doing that? What's going to happen next year when the state wants to contract with large firms to do things, to do healthcare services? What are those large firms going to say to themselves?
They're not protected, so they want protection in the contract.
They might, or they might just charge a higher price. That is to say that one of the risks of suing people, after all, is other people say, you're really not very nice people. We don't like doing business with you because we didn't cheat you, and you sued us, and we had to pay you off to get you to stop. We'll find another state to sell our services to. So my point is only that you, at some point in any contract, you want to think about whether there are further issues beyond this particular transaction's returns. And that, just in a sense, it's the same as the reputational arguments on the other side, that the law firm, I was going to say, you might argue, maybe you could argue, that giving the law firm 100% is too much, because at 80% they really have 100% incentive, because the other 20% is made up by their reputational incentives, right? So just as the law firm has reputational concerns, so the state attorney general's office has some reputational concerns about whether or not, and it goes both ways. On the one hand, if you've really been cheated, then the reputational effect is good, because then what are you doing? You're saying to firms that want to do business with the state, we're nice people, we're perfectly willing to do business with you on fair terms, as long as you don't cheat us. But boy, if you cheat us, you're going to see us in court. All right. Well, that's a good reputation to have. Now, the honest firms like doing business with you, the dishonest ones don't. Great. So, in that sense, there's a sense in which moral issues aside, the state ought to care about whether the defendant is guilty or innocent. Right? You might say, you know, as a matter of moral issues, they ought to, that you shouldn't sue people who've done nothing wrong. It may be too much to expect people whose, you know, professional career depends on doing what's seen as their job to be constrained by that kind of moral consideration. But you might also think, if especially if you're a long-term planner, imagine that the Attorney General is really the agent of the governor. The governor is part of a political machine that's going to be running this state for the next 20 years. You know, it's actually, he's not really an agent of the governor. He's really an agent of a guy called Daley, who's the mayor of the big city involved in it. In fact, in that particular case, if I'm not mistaken, the guy who is now mayor of Chicago was city attorney, city or state attorney general, I forget what, at some point. But in any case, the point I'm making is only that, and even more of a point for a firm than it is for a state, because firms have secure property rights. The stockholders only lose their share of the stock if they sell it, whereas you can argue that state governments ought to be fairly short-term, because who knows, they'll run the state, you know, next election. But that you do want to think about the implications of your litigation or other things in your contract for your future situation. I think that makes some sense.
All right.
Let's go back now, having sort of done one application, to some of the general points that the book is making, and maybe a few other points should be made, and there. Focusing largely on principal-agent contracts. And those ought to matter to you because, as an attorney, you're in fact going to be an agent. The logic of a principal-agent contract is that you have two parties, one of whom does the job and one of whom gets the benefit, and then the contract is designed, that's clearly an unworkable arrangement, all right? So the contract is designed to modify that arrangement so the guy who does the job has some reason to do the job, which he wouldn't if you just said, you know, you do the work, I get the pay. Right, not a sensible thing. Examples, the hiring someone to build your house is a principal agent contract. We discussed that at some length. Almost all employment contracts are, all right? You, the Santa Clara Law School, or maybe the university is the principal, I'm the agent. And how do they give me an incentive to erase blackboards? In order that the next person won't have to do it, waste his time doing it. Well, one way is by having me teach the classes in the same room consecutively, or at least with only one class in between, so that I'll have my own mess to clean up. All right. But lawyer, client ones, you the lawyer or the agent? How about political ones? Is the president our agent? Is Obama, are you the principal? Are we the principal and he our agent? And if so, how might we want to structure that contract? We won't limit to Obama. You can, you know, include Mr. Brown and whoever is the mayor of San Jose or Santa Clara at the moment and so forth. Are there ways we might want to structure the political contracts, thinking in terms of the logic of this? How do we, in fact, reward political elected politicians? What?
Re-election.
There are really two different rewards. One, we pay them a salary, and the other is they do or don't get reelected. All right? Salary is a fixed fee contract. Now, you could argue, depending on the political system, in many political systems, politicians have ways of making money out of their office, which aren't fixed fee. That Lyndon Johnson became wealthy, if I remember correctly, in the radio industry at a point when he was, I think, the chairman of the relevant Senate committee, and his wife was running radio stations, and it mattered a lot having the government on your side if you wanted to run radio stations, because licenses were being handed out by the government. And you can think of, I'm sure, Mr. Mubarak, that his income is not limited to whatever his salary is, which is one of the things he will complain about. But at least in the sort of formal official legal system, it's a fixed fee. And then the re-election is an outcome measure. All right, the re-election reflects people's view of how good a job he did. Is it a very good outcome measure? That one of the problems with all of these outcome measures is how you measure it. So that let's take the most recent example, the last elections. Those elections arguably were won mostly by the Republicans because the Democrats were being punished for a bad outcome. Is that a fair statement? What actually happened? You know, there are a lot of other things involved as well. But a good deal of it was unemployment was high, things looked bad. I'm not sure if they would have done better if they hadn't made optimistic predictions a couple of years before, that the Democrats hadn't. But in any case, you can view that as a reward by outcome system. What's the obvious problem in that? Yeah.
I'm not sure that's the one you're looking for, but people might be poor assessors of outcomes. There might be far better people out there to assess outcomes.
In this particular case, what is the greatest danger in terms of misassessing? My impression is that things like the unemployment rate at the time of election have a heavy effect on electoral outcomes. Yes?
Cause and effect. So the cause of the unemployment.
More generally, the fact that you're looking at current circumstances, that on almost any plausible theory, there are sizable time lags in the system. So that there are all sorts of cases where doing the right thing, take a different one than this one, which is if you've got a inflation rate running 10% a year and it's been doing it for the last 10 years, if you choose to stop printing money and bring the inflation rate down, there are reasons to expect that the short-term result will be a rise in unemployment. May or may not be the right thing to do, but it's going to look like the wrong thing because if you do it today and the election is 4 months from now, 4 months from now, the inflation rate still looks high, and the unemployment rate is high, you get voted out. All right? And in this case, as it happens, I'm not an admirer of Mr. Obama's economic policies, but even if he was right, you don't know, there's still the argument, which could be true, that what's really going on was the result either of the Bush administration or some exogenous factors that neither of them is responsible for, and maybe he did the best job he could of coping with it. So that the problem there, but it's a problem which applies not just to elected officials, that in general, you know, when you reward your coffee shop manager for outcomes, those outcomes might or might not be the result of his work. I was actually just listening on the radio coming in to Dr. Laura, who is somebody who I do not have a very high opinion of personally, but who clearly is very confident in what she does if you listen to her, which is do a talk radio thing, giving people advice on their lives and families and things. And she was talking to someone who was concerned with the fact, I came in the middle, but I think what was going on was that her daughter, who was I think a sophomore in high school, had flunked geometry. And the question that the mother was asking was, should I punish her? And Dr. Laura very reasonably said, but I should say Dr. Laura started out by saying that she did very badly in geometry too. She never could understand geometry, so she may have been biased on this case. But that her argument was that you punish somebody for being lazy and not studying, you don't punish somebody for having the kind of mind that isn't good at understanding mathematics, which seems to be a perfectly reasonable point. But if you only look at the outcome, it takes more information to say, is the reason she flunked geometry the fact that if she had spent twice as long, she would still have flunked it. It just never makes any sense to her. Or is the reason the fact that she was out partying when she should have been doing her homework? All right, so that's a legitimate problem, and it's a legitimate problem any time you're trying to reward by outcome. Suppose you were organizing a big firm, General Motors, and you wanted to at least come closer to rewarding your employees by outcome than you used to, say. What's one way in which you might make it a little bit easier to do it? And I'm thinking of the way General Motors is, in fact, organized. Yep.
Establish objective rather than subjective outcome. Give some ownership to the employees.
That would be one. Well, ownership to the employees doesn't work very well because, after all, if you have 1 millionth ownership, that's not much of an incentive, or even 100,000. What I was thinking of is have subdivisions that functionally are like independent companies. You have, is Chrysler is or isn't GM? I forget. But anyway, it used to be the case. I think it still is. Buick is GM.
Cadillac is GM. And my understanding is those weren't just brand, those weren't just names of cars, that those represented what were in effect semi-independent companies within GM. And by structuring it that way, doesn't give you rewards at the factory floor level, but it means that the manager of that division, you can say, we're going to judge him not by how much money GM made, but by how much money Buick made this year. And then he's the manager of Buick. That's closer to being a measure of what he's doing. No?
Well, I think you can still track that, though. I think the fact that it's never coming
to the
matter, you're still
going to
see the data coming from
it. Yeah, except that the more what's going on is that Buick's legal costs are done by GM's lawyers as opposed to by Buick's lawyers, the harder it's going to be to separate it out. That's right. And my guess is that's part of the reason that you sometimes get these very large companies which look like several smaller companies. So I guess part of what I'm saying is that one of the things you might do if you wanted to reward by outcome is to try to structure your business in a way that makes it easier to measure outcomes, because that isn't always easy to do. So the basic alternatives, we've just run through them, are pay by performance. Did you sell a car, win a case, sell a house? Real estate agents, I guess, are probably one of the big cases where you're selling by performance. But again, not enough in a sense. All right, if you think about the case of a real estate agent, and if he spends more time and effort trying to sell your house, he can get you an extra $50,000. How much is it worth his spending on trying to get that extra
$50,000?
The point is that he's only getting a small percentage of that money, so if it costs him $5,000 to get you $50,000, he probably won't. There's a book you may have read called Freakonomics, which doesn't teach much economics, it turns out, but it has some nice examples of ingenious ways of testing obvious economic predictions. And this happens to be one of them. That's why I was thinking of it. Suppose we have a real estate agent who is selling two houses. One of them belongs to him, and the other he's selling as an agent. Which one is going to be on the market for longer? Which one is he going to make more of an effort to get the highest possible price for? The one he owns, he gets 100% of the gain. So therefore, it's worth keeping it on, you know, keeping trying, don't take this offer quite yet, maybe we'll get a higher one, whereas the one that he says an agent, he's got an incentive to say, well, you know, I'd rather get $10,000 for a month's work than $10,500 for 2 months' work. Turned out, as I remember from reading Freakonomics a couple of years ago, that real estate agents, when they have their own house on the market, the house remains on the market substantially longer, which I thought was sort of a neat little way of testing a pretty obvious economic prediction. And that's what, at least to my mind, the book, I didn't think it was any very interesting economics. You could do better with either my book or with Steve Landsberg's Armchair Economics. I'm biased, of course, because Freakonomics is a competitor of mine, and he did it much better than I did in terms of sales. But I don't think it really teaches you a lot of economics, a little bit, but it shows you neat ways of testing things, which is important. My first journal article, when I first sent it in, it was rejected by the editor of the journal on the grounds that I had no tests of my theory. It's a theory, I should say, of the size and shape of nations, of what determined the map of Europe for the last 1,500 years, roughly speaking. And George Stigler rejected it, saying that in order for it to be published, well, I needed to have some tests of my theory. And he had some suggestions, none of which were workable. But I, in fact, thought of ways of testing my theory, and I put those in and resubmitted and got published. And I concluded that what was really important was not that the tests told me whether the theory was true, because they don't. The tests give you a little evidence about that. But that figuring out how you would test a theory results in your thinking through much more clearly what the theory says. That as long as it's just words, you can sort of be vague about things. But if you say, well, all right, what numbers would tell me that it's true or not, you now have to specify it much more clearly. So I think that the paper, even if the published version had left out all the tests, it would have been a better paper as a result. Now, I should say, this was a somewhat odd case, because George Stigler was somebody I had known since I was a small child. He was one of my father's best friends. But he, I think, treated me honestly, and I was better off as a result. He rejected the article when it should have been rejected, and accepted it when it should have been accepted. I'm sort of proud of that article because at some point I came across somebody's summary of the literature on size of nations. Mine is the first article in that literature. The second is by Jim Buchanan 10 years later. Then there are a bunch of other things by other people. So that was sort of neat. My usual theory, by the way, is fire and forget. That's the only article I've written on that subject. I said what I had to say and I went on to do other things. And I think that's, if any of you are going to be academics, maybe I'm wrong, but I think there's a good deal to be said for a prejudice in favor of fire and forget, that it's too easy, having done one good piece of work, to then spend the rest of your life defending it and arguing about it and so forth. And my ex-student, John Lott, who co-authored a very controversial article on concealed carry laws, I think ended up, in my opinion, making that mistake. But anyway. All right, so we get the usual kinds of stuff we've just been going through, that you can pay for inputs, you can have a fixed fee, but you can also and probably often should have combinations, that they're real estate agents really are on a pure output measure arrangement. But I think most salespeople, I think, have a salary as well as getting a bonus for selling, and certainly there are a lot of employment contracts where people get bonuses if things go well. I remember at one point I knew the details of what Google was doing because I had a son working for them, and they had some deal where if your group did really well, you could get, like, you know, divide up $1 million among the members of your group, that kind of reward. But they also had pretty generous salaries as well as very good free food. Let me go back to the president, to the case of the president, which is sort of interesting. Suppose you wanted a way of rewarding the president that was an outcome-based measure better than the ones we use. Well, let's move it for a moment. Suppose you want to reward the CEO of the company by an outcome-based measure that's better than simply saying how much money they made this year. Because after all, maybe the reason they didn't make much money this year was they were putting all of their money into research on great products that are going to make them a lot of money next year. What might be a better measure of how the CEO is doing? Yeah?
One way is the way football coaches are given.
Tell me, how do they do it?
So they give a contract extension.
Contract what?
Extension. So you say for the next 5 years you're guaranteed to make this amount when your contract is coming up. So you get a little disincentive to maybe work hard, but at the same time later you're like, you're going to want another contract extension, so you're going to keep your So that could be one way.
How else might you measure? Take a CEO. A coach, you're in pretty good shape because I presume how many games he wins is a pretty good measure, although there may be some present future trade-offs. Maybe he's training his people in new methods that aren't going to work this year but will work next year. But how might you measure a CEO's performance? We actually had quite an interesting market-based measure of value of CEO quite recently, although it was a little tricky, and that was when Steve Jobs announced that he had medical problems and was taking a leave of absence, and there was various discussion of how much the Apple's market cap dropped when he did that. And the conclusion of some people was that it didn't drop all that much, and that was evidence that whether by Steve's activity or other people, they had a good second line of people. But one way you might do it is by the value of the stock. That after all, the value of the stock is an evaluation of how people who've actually got money at stake think the company is doing in the future, not just how it did this year. Suppose you want to apply that to the president. Suppose we're sort of thinking as science fiction writers who can imagine a variety of different institutions. How would you get the equivalent of that for the president of the U.S.? Yep.
You get the value of the T-bill?
Well, that's telling you one very limited thing. That's telling you how likely people think it is that you're going to default on your loan, on your
total investment. So don't they look at the monetary value of the country?
I've got a better solution. It's not original with me. It was thought up by somebody else I know. And that is make citizenship marketable. Suppose you say anybody who is a U.S. citizen can sell his citizenship to anybody else who is not a U.S. citizen. They then get the right to citizenship, he loses them. Well, there's a sense in which the value of that citizenship is a pretty good measure of how well the country is being run and how many people want to live in it. Okay? Now, I should say he was also suggesting that you could carry the metaphor to companies a little further by allowing takeover bids. So you could allow somebody to buy multiple. Suppose I think that Obama's doing a lousy job, and that if only we could throw out him and the Democrats in the Senate and put in some good Republicans or Libertarians or whatever I'm in favor of, the country would do much, much better. And supposing I bought a really lot of money, and nobody has this much money, unfortunately, for the argument, but supposing I did. So what I do is that I buy up 50 million citizenships. Citizenship includes the right to vote. Now, people don't want to really have to leave the country. So I, in effect, lease the citizenships back to the people I bought them from. So I own the citizenship. You're paying me an annual fee to be allowed to be to use my citizenship to give you residence in the U.S., but I have the vote. So now, the next election, I have enough votes, so we throw out the people who I think are doing a bad job, put in the good people, and I then sit back and watch. And if I'm right, a couple of years, the rest of the world sees how much better run the country is. People really want to live here. The price of my citizenship's quadruples, and I have just made myself several $1 trillion. So it's not, I think, a viable scheme, except maybe for much smaller countries than the U.S. But it's nonetheless an intriguing idea if you think about how you would try to get the kind... Because on the face of it, you would expect corporations to be as badly run as countries, because in the case of a corporation as in a country, the individual stockholder has such a small share of the benefit that why should he pay any attention? Just as most American voters are rationally ignorant, they don't know what the government is doing, what it should be doing, because they have no reason to, because their vote won't change the outcome. Ditto for stockholders. And one of the ways in which you expect corporations to do better than governments is the possibility to take over. The fact is, it's clear that somebody else could run it better. Someone buys up enough stock to change. So it's sort of a fun idea. You could do it as a science fiction story, maybe, to try to imagine how you would get the equivalent of that. Anyway, let me keep going on. As we said before, the three basic problems, two basic problems really for most of them, PR was a special case, the two basic problems are incentive and risk sharing, and that you give, that the more of the return goes to the agent, the more he has an incentive to try to get the good return. On the other hand, the less the principal does, and in some cases, as in my settlement case, the principal may still be able to affect what happens. And on the other hand, if the costs are being borne by the principal and the benefits by the agent, now the agent has an incentive to bear too much costs. So, again, if the agent made all decisions, ideally you'd like the agent to bear the costs and get the benefits. That would give him all the right incentives, but that's not a very good result from a risk-spreading issue if the agent is risk-averse and the principal isn't. Right? So that's sort of very simple kind of argument. And the other problem, of course, is that in many cases, not all of the outcomes are easily measurable. So if you think about the case where the agent is a physician and you're the patient, there isn't really a way in which I can transfer all of those. It's a little tricky to see how I transfer all of the benefits to him since I'm the one who gets sick, not him. But I actually have a friend, I've got lots of clever friends, who has an interesting scheme along those lines. And his argument is that basically... one of the problems with medical care is that the individual patient doesn't have enough expertise to know if the right things are being done, given trade-offs between costs and benefits. And the agent doesn't have the right incentive to do it. So this is Robin Hanson, I should say, who's a very bright, weird guy who's at George Mason University, comes up with interesting ideas. And his scheme goes as follows. And this is, we're going to assume for simplicity that all you care about is living. Forget about quality of life, which would make it more complicated. So I say to myself, how much is my life worth? It's a funny question, except for an economist. But everybody implicitly makes it because you say, look, suppose this very expensive treatment increases my life expectancy by a year. Or suppose by buying a more expensive model of the car, which has got better brakes and is more solidly built, I can lower by 1 in 1,000 my chance of dying in a traffic accident. We all do make decisions like that, even if we don't explicitly put them in the value of life. So suppose you decide the value of your life is $10 million, that you're willing to pay up to $10,000 to reduce the chance of dying tomorrow by 1 in 1,000. Well, what you then do is that you go to the physician or the firm that represents the physician, I've got a deal for you. And the deal is that if I die, you pay my estate $10 million. In other words, I'm buying $10 million of life insurance. That would be a little more complicated in terms of when I die and so forth, but I'm going to ignore all the complications. In exchange, you agree to decide what medical treatments I should have, and you're going to pay for all of them. And I will pay you an annual fee to cover both the cost of the life insurance I'm buying and the expected cost of the medical treatment. So now the life insurance medical company says to itself, well, his dying costs us $10 million. If we can prevent his dying at a cost, if we can reduce the chance of his dying at a cost that's sensible at $10 million, if I say we can, by having this medical procedure, we can reduce the chance of dying by 1%, that's going to save us $100,000. So if the procedure costs less than $100,000, we should do it. Or we shouldn't. All right? So we've just transferred both the cost and the incentive to a firm which is expert in medical matters and therefore can do a much better job than I can. So it's really, again, it's got real practical problems. It's a clever idea if you think of the general issue of constructing contracts to give people the right incentives. Now, it may have occurred to you that the one problem with this deal is that I now have $10 million of life insurance that I don't want. I may not want it. Maybe I don't have any family, for example. And I'm paying for that $10 million. But that's all right. Robin's got a solution to this. I now sell my $10 million of life insurance to somebody else. Find another firm which will pay me roughly the expected value in exchange for their getting to like the $10 million. And there's only one precaution I have to take. I've got to make sure the two firms don't talk to each other. Because if the two firms talk to each other, then the medical firm buys back the $10 million that it sold to me. It's still getting the payments from me and spends nothing at all on my medical care. Because it no longer is the one that's going to suffer if I die. Anyway, it's I think it's sort of a neat story. So let me give you a different version. One of the points the book makes very briefly in passing is that the argument for 100% contingency fee applies to every employee. All right, you've got a firm. You would like every employee, anytime he can save the firm at a dollar at a cost of 90 cents to him, to do it. And in order to do that, the employee is going to have to receive the full value of the firm's profits. And the book takes it for granted that that's unworkable. But they're not being imaginative enough, because just as in my attorney case, the way you get that is that people pay to the employees. All right? So then I would say, all right, I will have a negative, my salary will be minus $100,000 plus the firm's profits. All right. Now I've got the right incentive. If I get 100%, every the product go up by a dollar, I get 100% of that dollar. And on average, I'm just getting my normal salary because I'm giving the firm back as a fixed sum what they're paying me and minus my actual salary. Makes sense? What's wrong with it? Yeah.
Can you explain again?
Sure. We've got five employees. We would like every employee, whenever he has a choice that affects the profits of the firm, to make it as long as the increase in profit is larger than the cost to him. All right. Whether it's working an extra day, moving to a different town, whatever it is. Right. How do we do it? Well, the first way we do it is say to him, all right, your salary is the profit of the firm. And if you increase the profit, increase your salary by that amount. Oops, we've got a problem. We're now paying five times the profit of the firm to our employees. We're going to go bankrupt very quickly. Ah, that's all right. Because since the employees are now each getting enormously overpaid, on average, they ought to be willing to pay for the privilege. All right, they should be willing to go to the firm and say, look, on average, the profits of the firm are going to be $150,000 this year. If you were paying me a fixed salary, it would be $50,000. I'll pay you $90,000 a year. You will pay me the profits of the firm. On average, I'm getting $60,000. That's a better deal than $50,000. But I've now got the right incentives, so now the firm's going to make more money, so you like it too. What's wrong with this deal? There are two things wrong, one of which should be obvious. Why am I not going to be able to get employees on this deal? Yep.
Because it's contingent upon the, like if it's five, it's contingent upon the decisions of the other four.
Why is that a problem? I don't control the decisions of the other four. that as a random, there's a large random variation depending on the other four people do it, what the market is like, what our competitors do. Why is that a problem? The same problem we're running through throughout with our performance-based contract.
Your average, like your determining an average revenue of the company, like what you base your original payment on?
Was my estimate. Yeah, what they did last year or something. I got to make the best estimate. Yeah, I might get it wrong. I might get overpaid or underpaid. Either could happen. But what's the real problem with this contract for example, and employees?
A lot in 1 year, but not get enough that year.
May not get anything, right? Suppose they made this contract in 2008, and then you have an economic slump. No profit at all. Sorry about that. You pay us, but we're all right. First, just fine. We got 90,000 from you, 90,000 from here, 90,000 from him. No problems at all, right? So the risk of, it's a gap in the conflict between risk aversion and incentives. The fact that we're putting all of the risk on the employees, that makes sense? And they are probably in a very poor position to bear that much of a risk. They end up with negative salary if things go badly. Large negative salary if things go badly. All right.
What if you hedge the fact that the firm, if the firm loses money, they redistribute?
But the more you do that, then the less it is the case that they have an incentive to do anything that saves the firm a dollar and costs them less than a dollar. You can obviously have all sorts of compromises, and you do. I would just want to look at the pure form to see both its advantages and its disadvantages. Now, it has another disadvantage, as it turns out, which is somewhat less obvious, but which I really referred to in a sense a minute ago, and that is you have to worry about what happens if the employees talk to each other. Because suppose you've got two employees, and one of them says to the other, you know, if you work the extra hour, which from your standpoint is a $10 cost in terms of the value of your time, that would make $9 for the firm. And you say, yeah, well, I'm not going to do it. Talk to him, wait a minute. It's not only $9 for you, it's $9 for me, too. Because each of us is getting the full profit of the firm. So the two of us together are getting twice the profit of the firm. So that extra hour is going to cost you $10. It's going to make up between us $18. I'll give you a little bit of my share, so work the extra hour. So that if they actually got together, you then get the wrong incentive. You don't have too much of an incentive. You now have everybody working too hard. Whether or not that's the case, if you assume that the contract terms take account of the incentive effects, if that's going to happen, then people are going to find themselves working very many hours and will only agree if they get paid a lot. But since they're going to be working hours beyond the hours where the productivity of the firm justifies the hours, that's going to be a net cost for the firm. So if you think it through, once people start coordinating, you have a problem. And a little bit analogous to in our game theory discussion, the problem with Nash equilibria breaking down once people coordinate. Because two guys can rush the guard with the one bullet in his gun, even though one guy wouldn't. So your prediction depended on independent action, and that's true here as well.
Is that a bad risk for the firm if you're giving them a correct percentage? Because maybe the percentage is too high, then they start coordinating.
But if the percentage is less than 100%, then if they don't coordinate, they have to run the test. That's the tension in the logic. This is one of the many cases where there really isn't a way of doing it right in the sense. There may be a least bad way of doing it. But doing it right from the incentive standpoint requires every firm getting 100%, every employee getting 100% of the return. That's dreadfully bad from a risk aversion standpoint, and it also is bad from an incentive standpoint if they go where they. All right, so that's a problem. Not like there's an answer to it. It's just seeing that problem is going to help you see how, in a more realistic case, you've got trade-offs and tension between rewarding by results and risk aversion. And the other problem is the tension between rewarding by results and measuring results. In fact, George Stigler, who I mentioned before, I should say, if you want some interesting light reading, Stigler was very good at writing funny essays that made serious points. He's also a Nobel Prize winning economist. He was a very serious scholar, interesting guy. And one of them describes a imaginary South American country where some young intellectual, I think like his father wins the revolution or something, and a young intellectual is put in charge of the university system. And the university system works very badly. And so he starts setting up incentive schemes. And each of the incentive schemes that in the imaginary story is set up for how you reward professors, each of them then breaks down as the professors figure out how to game the system. So, for example, you want to measure their research output. Well, how do you do that? You have their papers graded by an independent expert in North America, at which point the professors start going off North America and studying with the people who are going to grade them so they know what kind of papers to write so those people get a good grade. You get rewarded by, furthermore, they spend no effort at all on teaching their graduate students because their graduate students are going to be competing with them, right? The better the graduate job the graduate students do, the worse the professor will look. So we then have the fancier version in which you get some credit for how you do and some credit for how your graduate students do. And I don't remember how he runs all of them. It's quite neat because his real point is the difficulty of measuring outputs. And he's doing it in his own field, namely professors. So today, if you want some fun reading, one of the books of essays is called, I think, The Intellectual in the Marketplace. And I think there's one other whose name I forget. I can probably find it, though, if you're curious. But the other person who's very good at this, by the way, is Seymour Parkinson. Have any of you ever heard of Parkinson's Law? That's not what people teach them nowadays. Parkinson's Law is work expands to fill the time available. And you have surely all observed it. And if you want a job done, give it to a busy man. And the other statement of Parkinson's Law is the number of people employed by a bureaucracy increases at a constant rate, independent of whether the work to be done increases, decreases, or whether there's any work at all. And this sounds like a joke, but he's got data. He has figures on the onshore establishment of the British Navy, the basically bureaucratic part of the British Navy, during a period when England went from the greatest naval power in the world to barely able to beat Argentina. Number of employees keeps going up. He has figures for the number of people employed by the colonial office, I think it is, by the body that's basically administering the British Empire during the time when the British Empire vanishes. Number of employees keeps going up. So Parkinson's Law, when he wrote a bunch of these books, Parkinson's Law is the first and most famous. But in almost all of them, he's writing a funny essay that's worth reading for entertainment, but that has serious points buried in there. So, more fun way of educating, getting educated and reading. I guess I have one more case, kind of the thing I could talk about, but I'm not going to. Let me talk about the case where you have a joint project where the firms are doing different things. You've really got sort of two kinds of joint projects. You've got joint projects like a law firm in which all of the partners are roughly speaking doing the same thing and you're trying to decide how to divide up the cost and benefits. And then you've got joint projects where two firms are each contributing a different part to the project. And the example I was thinking of, because it's a real world example, was Apple Computer. At the point when the chips that Apple was running on, the CPU, were being made by Motorola and IBM. And you had some kind of a contractor's form, I don't know, but in which IBM is saying, we'll provide you chips with certain characteristics, with certain costs. Apple saying, we'll buy those chips. And IBM is making decisions on developing the chips, and Apple is making decisions on designing computers and marketing them. And what in fact happened was that Steve Jobs informed the Apple marketplace that he would have desktops running at 3 gigahertz within a year, and he didn't. And the reason he didn't was that IBM was making the transition to a new process for making chips in which they were making smaller chips, 60 nanometer chips, which nobody had effectively produced it before. And it turned out to be harder than IBM thought. And the result was that IBM was producing like, you know, one little card which you cut up and it's got 1,000 chips, and 900 of them didn't work. So you got a very high failure rate, which meant a very high cost and the inability to produce the quantity that Apple needed, and that's part of the reason why Apple now run on Intel chips, because Apple decided to switch. But if you think about the situation when they're drawing up the contract, IBM had the expertise on how good a job they're going to do.
IBM controls the inputs that are going to affect how quickly they can get high quality chip. But if Apple decides that Steve Jobs is going to open his mouth and promise people 3 gigahertz desktops, and then look very bad when they don't show up. He's the one who decides what their plans are for their new machines. Do you have laptops? Laptops are more power sensitive. That is affected by chips and so on and so on. And there's a large random factor that almost certainly IBM really believed they'd be able to do these 60 nanometer chips. I guess eventually they did, but they took a, had a much harder time than they expected. So that's a case where you might think about how you would draw up the contract. How do you give Apple the right incentive, give IBM the right incentive, and allocate? I'm out of time because I talked about lots of things that weren't on my outline, but hopefully were more fun than the things that were.